Hello, all of you out there in Radioland. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM on your radio dial. And for our virtual listeners, stay tuned to kptz.org. Our website's more than a way to listen to today's music. For example, you can find the biographies of all our hosts and DJs. You can look up calendar listings to see what's happening around town. You can even sample some of our earlier shows. In fact, much of the original programming on KPTZ is currently available as podcasts. You know, double your listening pleasure. Listen to today's show as well as some earlier ones. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around the area? Who was that guy racing down San Juan on inline skates? I didn't know those were back in style. Meanwhile, kudos to the bicycle lady who actually stopped at a stop sign. It's bewildering that bicyclists don't seem to think the rules of the road apply to them. Frankly, I'm actually surprised more of them don't get into nasty accidents. On the lighter side, who drives that red van with the white bull painted on its side? And come to think of it, who drives the red and white truck with seven fishes painted on the side? The fishes are accompanied by a little painting of a hula dancer. Sort of a mixed message there, don't you think? Jefferson County is full of all sorts of fascinating characters. This show, Our Town, tries to profile a few of the singular personalities who live here. But the show's only a half hour long, which is definitely not long enough to do justice to some of our fellow citizens. So it's a synopsis. We try to get our guests to talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up on the western edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, right at Vancouver Island, Canada. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otter, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. Today, my guest is Wayne Chimenti. Many of you know Wayne either as a captain of the Adventurous or the director of the Community Boat Project, but he's also masterminding a newer community project called Shelter from the Storm. It's designed to help those between the ages of 18 to 25. It's a segment of the community that can get overlooked. But before we get to that, let's get to know Wayne a little bit. Welcome to the show, Wayne.
Well, thank you, Marianne.
I always like to start with asking people whether they were born and bred here in Jefferson County. What about you?
Well, I was born and bred in New England. I was a Connecticut Yankee. The beautiful thing about coming to the West Coast is after you're here for about 10 years, everybody says, oh, you're a local. Where I come from, that would never happen after 10 years.
How long does it take?
There's an old Mainer story about a man who moved to Maine. He walks into Unc's store one time and he says to Unc, Unc, I've been here 20 years. I guess you'd call me a Mainer. And Unc looks at him and says, nope, wouldn't call you a Mainer. And so he says, well, my kids, they've been born in the state of Maine. And Unc looks at him and says, if your dog crawled into the oven and had puppies, now would you call them biscuits?
And did Unc ever say what the definition was?
Well, no, he didn't. But the bottom line is you don't belong.
So did you go to high school in Maine?
Well, I was Connecticut.
Connecticut. Okay.
Yep. I went to high school at Norwich Free Academy, the oldest high school in the country, right in Norwich, Connecticut, which is really a nothing town, but just north of Mystic. So that's where it gets its notoriety.
Yes. High school kids notoriously label each other as something or other. You know, he's a jock, she's a nerd, whatever. What do you think your peers labeled you at? Whether right or wrong, what did they think?
I think I was just one of those sort of nothing people. I don't think people thought about me much at all.
Really?
I wasn't really a bad kid. I was pretty smart, but I wasn't super smart. I wasn't nerdy. I was, I think, probably just one of those normal kids that everybody just overlooks.
So were you one of these kids who always knew what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Considering what I turned out to be, then that would be a no. I was always excited about the sciences.
Right.
And I pointed myself in that direction. and I still am a pretty enthusiastic science person, but it is not my career.
So did you study science in college?
Yep. I was a marine biology student. That was what my degree is in.
So you graduated with that degree. Did you immediately go on to get a job in marine biology?
I was on that pathway. Mm-hmm. We'll just say that. And then I ended up going down a small detour, which I'm still on. Right out of college, I had the opportunity to go on a schooner that was doing oceanographic work.
Cool.
It was a group called SEA, Sea Education Association, out of Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And Woods Hole is sort of the mecca for marine biology folks. It was supposed to be a semester at sea where you helped work the schooner half your time, as well as worked in the lab half the time.
That sounds like a really cool job.
I was on as a student for a semester.
Yes.
So I was really excited about the science. About halfway through it, I realized that the deck people had it together a lot more than the science people. Right after that, they offered me just a short one-month stint to stay and help working as a deckhand on the ship. As it turns out, I ended up being a sailor.
How'd your folks take your decision to be a deckhand?
My folks were pretty upset. I had already been scheduled to go into graduate school,
right,
and had a job working in the field. Those were both supposed to start as soon as I got back from the schooner.
Mm-hmm.
By taking that one-month job, I missed the beginning of those opportunities. And I would say that my parents were very upset about it. For them to have a son who got through college with pretty good grades was really the fulfillment of the American dream for them. To have him then detour to be a sailor was just not in their world.
Wow. Did it take a long time for them to come around?
Well, it took a long time for me to decide I really was a sailor. I always thought that I would go back to sciences. I mean, right in the back of my mind was always, I'm going back to grad school. Every time I was ready to go back, some other opportunity that you just could not say no to.
Well, use an example. What was something where you were pretty close to going to grad school and then you got offered?
I was coming up the coast and I was really ready to start that application process again. I'd been down the Caribbean for a season. We pulled into Norfolk. There was a schooner. It had a Guernsey flag on it. This was a big, 120-foot topsail schooner. And I just walked over to say hi, and I said, what are you doing? And they're like, oh, we're going to Boston. I think that was the 1980 tall ships gathering. It was a big deal. Then they were going to go to Europe and follow the tall ships circuit around all summer.
Wow.
And I said, oh, God, what a job. I would love to do something like that. And he just looked at me. I mean, I hadn't given him a resume. We had talked 10 minutes, and he said, my French mate is leaving in Boston. Meet me in Boston in 3 weeks, and you can be mate of the boat.
Wow.
We had about 2 weeks to deliver that other schooner north. I remember walking into my parents' place in Connecticut and saying, okay, I'm heading to Boston. And of course, we're talking the time of no cell phones or anything.
Right, right.
None of that communication stuff. And of course, this was a very basic schooner too. Both of them were. I said, I'm getting on the train to Boston. The next time you hear from me, either I'm going to be in Europe or I'll be home in 2 days.
Yeah, that must have gone down really well.
It was just another Wayne moment for them.
Obviously, you sailed off to Europe.
Yeah, I just remember it was just these scenes that are just impregnated in your head. And I remember getting off the train in Boston. It was late at night, like 10 o'clock at night. It had rained, but the rain was gone. There were puddles everywhere. And I found my way down to the naval shipyard where all the tall ships were. And all the tall ships, the big guys, had all their lights on. And it was a little bit misty. Those lights were reflecting in the puddles and in the fog. It felt like I had just opened the time warp to the 1800s. And I'm walking down this whole dock of tall ships. And of course, by now it's 11 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock at night. It's pretty quiet. And I'm just looking for this boat, which was named El Pirata. And I find it. It's real quiet. There's no lights on board. And I go walk on board and somebody says, who's that? And I said, well, I think I'm going to be the mate. They'll go take that bunk over there. And I went to sleep. I woke up in the next morning and we had one day to prep the boat. And we left for Europe
Wow. Where did you go? What places did you hit on that trip?
Oh, every week we were in a different port. You know, we went across to Scotland. We went through Scotland. There's a thing called a Caledonia Canal, which actually cuts straight across Scotland. Went to Norway, Sweden, Denmark, all different ports in England.
What an adventure.
It was a fantastic thing.
When we were talking the other day, you told me that for a number of years, you sort of drifted around the world on different boats.
Yep. From the time I started sailing, I was either on a boat or living in a van. There was a stretch of about 5 years that the longest time I had been ashore was for 2 weeks.
Wow. Were there any countries that you spent more time in than others?
No, I just followed the jobs. When you sail, you can be a day sailor, you can be a coastwise person, an inland sailor, or you can be a blue water person. I was a blue water person, so I was always flying to the job in some other country.
Not all of our listeners will understand the term blue water. Most will, I think, but explain it.
This is Port Townsend.
Yes, I know it is Port Townsend, but...
The blue water is when you were traveling across oceans.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, internationally. That was almost my entire career until I came to Port Townsend and took the adventurous job.
So how did you end up in Port Townsend? What happened?
I met my lovely wife in Tahiti, and we had bopped around boats for about 2 years together. Then we were saying, okay, it is time to find a place to put our books. We were ready to not necessarily just drop the anchor altogether, but we wanted a place to come back to rather than living in vans. We could live anywhere in the world at that stage because I was flying from boat to boat. She's Belgian. I'm from Connecticut. We were spending a lot of time in the South Pacific at that time, so we were really like New Zealand. We were slowly building some kind of nest egg. We got called to Seattle to rig a ship. So besides sailing boats, I have developed the sidelines of rigging tall ships and making sails for tall ships. Mm-hmm. They were building a boat called Tullamore. It was a 150-foot, three-masted topsail schooner. At that stage, it was the biggest sailing boat built in the States in 50 years. I was in charge of the rigging and sails. It was a great opportunity for us both to work. We had never been to the Northwest, never thought of coming to the Northwest. We unfortunately drove out here in July, which, of course, is so magnificent.
Yeah.
We didn't see a cloud for weeks, and these mountains, these inland waters. And then we found Port Townsend, and I said, oh, my God, that is a sailor's town. If we could live within a half hour of Port Townsend, that is about as good as a sailor gets.
Wow. So what year was that?
That was about 86, 87.
You mentioned you're from Connecticut, she's from Belgium. Did either of you feel the lure of going back to your roots?
I think that she does not feel the lure to go back to Belgium, except to maybe the pastry shops and the cheese and the beer. But I don't think that the wild horses could make her live in Belgium again. I'm a little bit more connected to New England. I mean, New England's a place with a very nautical heritage.
And right.
It has a little bit more to offer than Belgium. Belgium's one of the most crowded places in the world.
So you found Port Townsend. Did you buy a place?
We started looking around Port Townsend almost every weekend looking for land. Mm-hmm. Our real estate person had been an ex-sailor, a woman who had been out of the Caribbean charter trade. She was just wonderful about understanding us, looking out for us. We were honestly about 2 weeks off sailing this boat to the Marshall Islands, and we were going to help do the maiden voyage with it. I was slammed as far as work to get the boat ready. Shirley had called and said, I found a place on Maristone you really should look at. And Nicole said, I'm going to go up one more time. My wife just came back and said, we're buying it. It was perfect. The timing was just really critical.
You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM on the radio dial. If you're online, we're at kptz.org. This show is called Our Town. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. Our Town's devoted to profiling some of the fascinating people who live and work on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, my guest, Wayne Cimenti, who is the director of the Community Boat Project, Wayne was just telling us of his years sailing all around the world and how he ultimately fell in love with Port Townsend and the Pacific Northwest. But I guess after you bought a place on Maristone, you did one last trip down to the Marshall Islands?
Well, I wouldn't say one last trip because we went to the Marshalls. Right afterwards, we had a rigging job in Holland. Then I went back to the Marshalls on that boat as captain. And then for the next 4 years, we're working 6 months in the Marshalls, and then 6 months I would have free. During those 6 months free, I would start to build my place because it was raw land that we bought.
Okay. How did you end up leaving the lure of being all around, but you somehow found a job with the adventurous?
Well, of course, our daughter had her first 4 birthdays on the Tolling Moor. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty great job. We were taking medical crews around the outer Marshall Islands. Great mission, great boat, and a great place to be. Unfortunately, there was some politics that came in, and the group Merrimed Foundation lost the contract to do that work in the Marshalls. And they decided that they wanted to take kids out of lockup in Hawaii instead. That was not going to be a great thing to be doing with your family on board.
No, I can see that.
So I did one trip and just said, that's not my mission. At the same time, Sound Experience had just bought the schooner Adventurous from a group called Youth Adventure. They were looking for a skipper. Mm-hmm. I had saw one of their board members, and he said, Wayne, would you consider doing the Adventurous? Now, I had never been an inland waters guy. And I said, well, you know, I never really thought about that, but I'll give you a season. I know you need a skipper to get started. And so I did that first season. As it turns out, it was such a wonderful group of individuals. I mean, everybody associated with that organization had incredible heart. And of course, it was this 80-year-old magnificent vessel. It was going to be 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. We could actually really build our home. So I ended up staying. I stayed with the Adventurous then for 13 years.
13 years, wow. And why did you decide to give that up?
It's an amazing job. I can remember this very distinctly. I was in the San Juan Islands. Of course, you just get to sail around the San Juans all summer long. These enthusiastic young kids on board, great crews. Yeah. And I just woke up one day and said, good gracious, I'm just not that excited anymore. And some 30-year-old skipper would die for this job. I think I was, I don't know, my early 50s at that stage. And I was like, I should get out of the way. Get out of the way and let somebody have this job. And I did. I honestly told him about a month later, okay, this is my last season.
And how did you end up at the Community Boat Project?
Well, I had been working with this very amazing educator, Marcy Van Cleef, ever since 1993. We had been doing different maritime programs together. Marcy wanted to start a boat building program for youth. She and I had been doing on-the-water programs for quite a while. Now she wanted to actually build her own boats and give kids that, those skills, those hands-on skills. At that stage, my wife and I were really doing a lot of study into something called voluntary simplicity, which was quite a trend in the early 90s. And we said, let's do that. Let's just try to cut every expense to a minimum. And I'm going to give Marcy 1 year and get this program up and running for her, just as a volunteer. As it turned out, that program was a huge success. The notion of voluntary simplicity really worked. Here it is now 11 years later, and we're riding this wave of the Community Boat Project, which is built into a phenomenal little organization.
How many kids roughly have been through that project over time?
It comes and goes, and it depends a little bit on what we do, particularly in the summers, because we have two solid programs, which is the boat building, which tends to have 14, 15, 16 kids in a standing wave, and then the on-the-water program, which has 8 to 10. Then we also get kids from youth probation. We also work with WorkSource on job training. We have open shop, kids that just come in and out. That's during the school year. In the summer, we might run 2-week intensives for either building something or for on the water. And then, of course, things like last year when we ran Felicity Ann Around the Sound, which was all women crews all summer long. So we like to say that about 50 people a year, 50 students a year, go on through the shop.
That's great. But lately, you've been turning your focus to young people a bit older, after the age of 18. Explain your thinking on why you see that group as someone you want to help.
Well, I think every organization is always looking for what's, you know, if you were to expand your program, what direction would you go in? Mm-hmm. And since our other programs are pretty solid, one thing that we noticed is that when you're in high school, no matter how rascally you are or how bad your family is or how good or bad a student you are, somebody's always watching for you. There's always the school district. I mean, you got to show up at school, and if not, they're sending the probation guys after you, and somebody's always trying to get you into some program. Somebody's always trying to get you
on
track. And there's
funding available
in different
programs.
There's funding, there's infrastructure, everything for that. And you really need to be in your house till you're 18, unless you're going to get yourself emancipated, and that's not that easy. Once you turn 18 and you get out of high school, nobody cares anymore. There's very few programs for you. The programs that they have are incredibly difficult to get into. At that stage, you are either maybe tossed out of your house or you want to leave your dysfunctional house, whatever it is. So that getting that first job and getting that little leg up into life is the hardest thing. And that we think of as 18 to 25. And that's really the group that we knew we had to serve. So we started this program, which is a paid internship, where these people who are out of high school can come in, they can make a little money, they can learn some job and life skills.
Like what?
So job skills are everything from construction. So, well, how to build anything. And that, of course, can be everything from just houses to cabinet work to boats. And then there's art that's associated with that. There's also a leadership component because you are very often the leader of the high school kids. We also do things like marine systems. So we just recently had a project. We were doing plumbing and we were doing electrical work.
Well, I saw some pictures of some tiny houses that your students have built. I guess, are these both from the regular program and the older people are supervising? How does that work?
Yeah, so of course, over the years, when we say it's a boat building program, actually we built everything under the sun. But we do boats, of course. But we also have done musical instruments. We have luthiers who come in and work with us. We have artists that come work with us, wood carvers. One thing that we tried about 3 or 4 years ago, and students just loved it, was building tiny houses. It's very empowering. People who are housing insecure, as many of these families are, and suddenly you can think, oh my God, I can build this little shelter for myself for a couple $1,000s. I mean, it's, you know, a couple months' rent. And they loved it, loved it, loved it. So the paid interns that we have now, when the students aren't in the room, we're building tiny houses. And so we're just finishing off our fourth tiny house. Along with that, the whole homeless crisis, which is all over the Northwest. Believe it or not, Jefferson County has a higher homeless rate than King County.
I didn't realize that.
Yep. It's a different kind of crisis because it's rural. There's people living in the woods all over the place. I don't think anybody even has any idea of what that real count is.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think anyone knows.
It's a big new thing that everybody's talking about in Jefferson County, and we're going to be part of that solution. And our part is going to be not only giving these young people the skills so they do not end up homeless, teaching them how to build their own shelter so that they can not be living in a tent, and then also be able to provide housing for some of the people who need it.
Well, as I said, I saw a few pictures of the tiny houses, and from the pictures, they look quite impressive.
We put art in everything we do. We want it to not just be a shell, not just be a shack. We want it to be a home. We want people to feel good when they're in there. We're willing to put that love in because people will feel that love.
Now, the Shelter from the Storm project or program, how long have you been doing that now?
Well, it has been a work of evolution. First, we started building tiny houses, mostly with the high school kids. Then we had some unpaid interns. We had some people from WorkSource coming in that was funded. Right now is really the launching of the actual program as it's starting to solidify.
Okay, and how are you funding it?
We're funding it by writing grants and partly by selling the tiny houses. Mm-hmm. So we try to keep that price really low for people. At some stage, we'd like to get to the stage where we can just give them away. Right now, that's not possible. But we are writing grants.
And I guess you've had some success at that.
We're writing a grant right now, yep, that we have, which is from a group called RPM. We are really in the final throes of something from the Medina Foundation. And also there's a local giving group called Better Living Through Giving. And we are down to the final four of people in that running. And we should know about most of that funding within, well, maybe a week from the Medina Foundation and maybe in about another 5 weeks from the Better Living Through Giving.
Wow, that's great. So you've now been living in Jefferson County for, what, 25 years, roughly?
Yeah.
And looking at it now, what do you find the most impressive about this area? What do you like?
I think that, of course, the natural beauty is just phenomenal. I drive off Maristone Island, and every day I look to the south, I see Rainier, I look to the west, I see the Olympics, and I just say I am so lucky to live in this environment. And the culture is great. I've been places where the land is beautiful, but the culture is terrible. I mean, it's very liberal, it's very earth-friendly, it's very people-friendly here. And then with the whole Chimicum Renaissance going on, now food, I mean, organic food, all this wonderful stuff is right at your fingertips. It's just so much to like about this place, at least for me. I mean, there's other people who would probably hate it, but I love it.
Yeah. Now, one issue people say is that younger people, like perhaps your daughter, find that there's not enough here for them.
I would say my daughter does not say that.
Good.
My daughter loves it here. Young people tend to like action, and if you like action, then you want to live in a city. There are not a lot of young people here, and that's a big discussion about why they're not here.
Yeah.
Part is because they don't want to be here, part of because the whole wave is gray, and part is because there's no housing.
Yes, yes. What can you say?
That's where that's at.
Okay, well, Wayne, believe it or not, we're basically out of time here. I want to thank you for being a guest on the show. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today is Ben Wayne Chiminti, director of the Community Boat Project. Thank you again. In addition to thanking Wayne, I also want to thank my partner, John McPherson. He's the man in the glass booth, the editor and producer of Our Town. He's the one who smooths out all the pauses and you-knows and grunts that slip into every interview. He makes me and my guests sound ever so intelligent and much more eloquent than we really are. KPTZ is a community radio station. All of us here at the station are volunteers. We need your support. We need your donations. KPTZ is currently housed in a trailer in the parking lot of the former Mountain View School. So, listeners, keep those donations coming in. I'm signing off for today, but keep listening to KPTZ Port Townsend for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.